When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you like what you're hearing right now? Then be sure to check out VOC Nation. Whether it's on VOCNation.com or your favorite podcast provider, VOC Nation offers the greatest in live and on-demand content, great interviews, and incredible insight from those who have lived the business. 7 days a week, VOCNation.com. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Welcome to another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the talk of wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. I'm bringing back my good friend today, my partner in crime, if you will, George Shire. There he is. George, how are you, sir?
I'm always good. You got it sounding like the dynamic duo.
I think we're going to be. I think we're already there.
Well,
what do you think?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, you asked if we wanted to do a podcast, and I said, well, yeah, let's just have a little banter back and forth. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, a few notes from the side. If you notice, ladies and gentlemen, I'm trying something, a different video service, StreamYard. That's why you'll see the duck up there, and it's the free version. And I've heard a lot of good things about them, so I'm going to try it and see how it works out. So far, so good, I hope. But I want to get into what we want to talk about today, Mr. Shire. And that's, you know, we've talked about the NWA in the past. But I want to get more specifically into, you know, how promotions got in, some of the things that may have occurred behind the scenes. I mean, I know Tim Hornbaker has the book of The Death of the Territories
good book, by the way.
It is a very good book. And other books. Hornbaker is a great author. He's a great researcher. He goes really in depth with the NWA. But I want to get your perspective on it. So tell us a little bit, if you would, about, again, maybe the come about of the NWA and how you had to get in to do it.
Well, it's interesting when you mention, you know, like how did they get in to do it and how it came about. Let me share this with you. Back when I was, I probably was 10, 12, 13 years old, I remember that people used to say about Major League Baseball, they would say that, or about wrestling, people would say, well, there's a million champions. You know, this guy's a world champion and that guy's a world champion. And the reason I mentioned Major League Baseball was back in the 60s, you had the American League and the National League. And there were 10 or 12 teams in each league. And throughout the entire season, they played. They didn't have interleague play or anything in those days, but they just played. And at the end of the season, whoever was at the top of both leagues, they played together in the World Series. There were no divisions in baseball like there is today. You know, you didn't have a West Division, a Central Division, and East Division and all that stuff like we do today. You didn't have divisional champions. You didn't have playoff games that got everybody and a wild card to get you into the World Series. So what I found ironic is that even though back in the day, people said, well, geez, you know, there's a million wrestling world champions. You know, you go this city and they got a world champion. You go that city, they got a world champion. And that pretty much was the case. But baseball, and there were other sports that did the same thing, but baseball itself just had those two divisions. Well, now today, as I just explained, you know, at the end of the baseball season, every section of the country has a champion. Last year, our Minnesota Twins, I live in Minnesota, we had the Central Division champions, Minnesota Twins. and they ended up in a playoff. They didn't make it any farther, but they didn't play in the World Series. But that's how it works today. So it kind of got me thinking about, you know, people used to say, well, geez, all these world champions in wrestling that we had. And what it really came down to, Brian, is we only had for a long time really one official recognized world champion sort of around the country with certain promotions here and there, smaller promotions, whatever, making their own champion or proclaiming somebody world champion. And the unique thing was, is promoters could do this and get away with it because you and I know, and we've talked about this, we lived in a much smaller, much more closed world where getting information wasn't always possible or instantaneous as it is today. Most of us as wrestling fans, and I say us, and probably should say me more than you because you are a little bit younger with me, you young pup. But, you know, when I started following wrestling in the 50s and then into the 60s, if you looked at the wrestling magazines, that was about the only time you could see that there were some other alliances. But other than that, if you didn't buy the magazine, you didn't subscribe to the magazine, fans were totally in the dark. And whatever their little television screen told them, the promoter, the announcer, in their territory, they took it as gospel. And there was no way really for them to find out that so-and-so really wasn't the world champion. Somebody else was, or however it worked. So, yeah, that's why, you know, when we were kind of chatting before the show, you know, like, what are we going to talk about? Well, I thought this would be kind of a good subject to kind of maybe...
It is. It's a good subject. It's interesting. It's very, I don't think it's talked about as much as it really should be. We tend to try to, you know, talk more about today's stuff, what happened on AEW, what happened. There's not a lot of the history of the, or really the starting of pro wrestling from, you know, the NWA forming in 48 and all the bumps in the road that happened. And I want to talk, I'd like to discuss that with you more and kind of figure out what we're, what, you know, what, what's going on.
And, you know, I think that's probably for most of the generation, my generation, and then the, those going forward. I think the 1948 thing is about the best way to start because if, those of us that are around yet, that's about as far back as we're going to go. You know, unless you're 80, you're going to go back pre-World War II and you'll be in the 30s, the 1930s. But I mean, I think 1948 is always a good starting point. And what happened there, what happened there, Brian, is there was a there was an NWA, but it wasn't National Wrestling Alliance. It was National Wrestling Association. And interesting, Lou Thesz, the man that, boy, I tell you what, Lou Thesz gets mentioned so many times. You know, people say, well, if you have a Mount Rushmore or you have a top 25 or top 100 or whatever you want to do, that if you don't have Lou Thesz at or near the top of the list, well, then the list isn't good. Believe it or not, there's a lot of credence to that because he really, really was just one of the flag bearers, the forerunners to what pro wrestling, at least after World War II, ended, that the boom started and Lou Thesz was part of that. So I mentioned that National Wrestling Association. Lou Thesz was champion of the National Wrestling Association three times. And in 1948, that was when that old group, the group we talk about, the Sam Muchnick and Pinky George, and I think Wally Carbo was in there, and Gust Karras, and that's something I should write down. I can never remember the six or eight promoters that all congregated to Iowa for this very, very first meeting with the idea we are going to vote, promoters will join what we're going to call the National Wrestling Alliance, and they are going to vote to have a wrestler be the one world champion, the one official world champion. And so it got off to a rather rocky start right from the beginning, because there were two finalists that were considered for this honor. One of them was Orville Brown. And Orville had been a great amateur wrestler. He'd been a great wrestler. I think he was out of Kansas City. Definitely was, like, in that era, he was one of the guys. So he was going to go into an elimination match with Lou Thesz, who had been the most recent National Association champion. And the match was set. And right before the match was to take place, that was when Orville Brown was in a serious car accident. It officially did end his wrestling career. And it really was then just by default, where because of Lou Thesz having those three association titles to his credit and the fact that he had worked with the promotion so well, they put him in as the first National Wrestling Alliance champion. Right. Now, the simplest way to explain it without getting into all kinds of really gritty details is each of these promoters that became a member of the National Wrestling Alliance. The way I understood it, there were dues that they would pay, whatever it was. It's like you're joining a fraternity or a club, and you paid dues. So promoter from certain territory city would pay his dues, become a member of the National Wrestling Alliance. He then would have a vote when they would get together for their annual meetings. And the National Wrestling Alliance did officially have an annual meeting, usually someplace around the country, where the original founders of the NWA and these promoters would get together, and they would discuss the NWA champion. That was it. And I will point this out, because I've said this to people. You know, a lot of times people say that the wrestling National Wrestling Alliance was a territory, or it wasn't. It really was basically just a champion. That's it. It didn't have a territory. What it was, though, is this group of promoters, along with all of those that were members of the NWA, they would vote on who the champion was going to be, if they were going to stay with the existing champion, or maybe they've decided they'd like to, you know, put a new guy in. And each person would have a vote. And I mean, it, in essence, in the short form, it was democratic, and that's the way it was done. So what the NWA champion would do, and being a member of the NWA, each of these promoters would be promised, at least on paper, they would be promised that they would be able to have the champion come to their territory maybe once or twice a year to defend the title against their number one guy. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that is that sometimes their top challenger was the top heel in the territory, or many times too, it was the top babyface. What the NWA champion had to do was, when he would come in, he had to play whatever role was opposite the opponent he was going to be facing. So generally speaking, he wouldn't be a hardcore heel if that was the case, if he had to play the heel role. But he certainly would use the tactics that, you know, the little bit behind the referee's back, a chokehold, or, you know, a slap here and there on the opponent, just enough to irritate the fans, or, you know, different aggressiveness that he would use. But the bottom line was, he could play that role, and definitely, and this was the key thing for the NWA champion, the promoters always wanted to pick a guy who, number one, could defend the business. And I say the business in the sense that we know wrestling was kayfabe. We know that wrestling titles weren't given to people. They weren't necessarily won. But that champion had to be able to go into a town and always make the challenger he was against many times look better than he probably really was.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if it was a smaller territory or whatever the case may be, that NWA champion had to go in and put over Joe Schmo, and I'm just throwing that out, but
right,
make him appear to the fans that he had the champion on the ropes, that he had the champion that close to defeat, that he was able to do it, but you know, the referee didn't see the pin, or the guy got disqualified, or whatever it was. But when they went home, they had to believe that their babyface, he was just that close to winning the title. And that was good, because the promotion then could hopefully boast a rematch, which was always the way you did wrestling. You wanted to promote that return bout, that reason to get even, whatever it was. And so that's what the NWA champion had to do. And then aside from the fact that he had to be able to, when I say defend the title, I mean that in the sense that he really had to know how to protect the title if his opponent decided he may want to go, as they called it, go into business for himself and try to, you know, put the champion down and beat him. So if that opponent did that, the NWA champion had to be just good enough to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
And maybe the finish in some cases would have been changed because of that, and that was the reason for it.
Speaking of that, you know, you talked about that politics in the NWA. Hornbaker goes into that pretty deep, but I want to talk about it with you. You know, you had a fee every year of, I think it was $500.
Yeah, I have it written down somewhere. I don't remember.
I think it was about $500 a year for a promotion.
Which then was big money.
Was a lot of money. Yeah, right. But I guess my question is why, you know, like, and I don't know if they did this back then or not, but like the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, they have these owners, right? And they have one guy at the top. He's the president. And then they have all these committees, subcommittees, and they have owners. Because back in the NWA, in the when it was first formed, I mean, if you got upset as a promoter and you were in the NWA, you'd just say, I'm leaving, I'm out, you know? Yeah. And then maybe a year later, okay, I'm over it. I'm back in. I want to be back in. And I believe they had to vote on you to be in or out. But I guess why didn't they just say, okay, you just can't pull out whenever you want? Was there a reasoning behind that?
Well, I think you touched on it a minute ago. I think you obviously, any promoter, it was up to the promoter or the territory if they wanted to be a part of the NWA. The main thing that happened when you all of a sudden had this voted on world champion, and let's go back to what Sam Muchnick's role was in this. For the major part of the history of the NWA, most people will concede that Sam Muchnick was the glue that kept it together. He always seemed to be the diplomat when there was, you know, certain promoters that had issues with, you know, not getting the champion enough, or you know, some other promoter getting, you know, his way more, or I didn't get my guy in as champion. Usually Muchnick, for whatever reason, most wrestlers that I've heard over the years, they said Sam was fair. Sam, you know, and I'm not making him to be a saint or anything, because I don't think any promoter was ever 100% upfront all the time. The business by its very nature is not that way. But Sam basically was the, as I said, the glue that kind of just kept things tight. So his main role in this NWA president title was that he was the one that booked, for the most part, the recognized champion. And Sam got, and again, I don't remember the exact percentage, but Sam and the NWA, let's just say, got a percentage
Right.
I think it was like 3% or something.
I think it was 2 or 3%.
I don't want to be quoted on that. That's stuff I could have looked up and I didn't. I always try to pull it out of my brain. But
all right,
he got a percentage each time the champion went to a town. He got a percentage of the champion's booking gate, whatever it was. And I think it was around 3%.
Yeah.
The percentage isn't important. It's just that that's how it worked. Right. So the hand was always on the fact that if a promotion, a territory wanted the champion, they would have to go through Sam. And eventually Sam would, you know, pencil that guy into the territory, however it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. The thing was, it really was a fairly cohesive way of doing it for well over 2.5 decades.
I mean, yeah.
It worked pretty good. That's not to say that you didn't have those guys that said, you know what, I haven't been able to get the champion for 1.5 years here. You know, I'm tired, bum. You know, all right. And I think it would have been fun to be a little mouse sometimes and be in the room of these annual meetings. Because you have to realize that wrestling, again, by its very nature, is a business that is filled with egos.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in the wrestling business and you didn't have an ego, you're not going to be in the wrestling business for long. Let's say that up front. But every promoter felt that he was the best. And when I say he on these things, I know there were later on there became some lady promoters and things. We're basically just talking about the beginning here. So if I throw he in there, I don't want any not being politically correct or something, you know. But
I think you're okay.
Okay. Well, I never know today. You know, you can say good morning. Good morning, and they tell you that you're not being politically correct. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've been around too long. So, but the thing is, the meetings were basically. And we've talked about this, Brian. The NWA champion, usually, they wanted whoever that representative was, they wanted him to, in most cases, hold the title for about 2 to 3 years. That was the general, if we put the title on you, you're going to be champ for 2 years or 3 years. And the reason for that, twofold. Number one, it gave the title credibility.
Yeah.
You had a guy that for 3 years was going around the country. And I mean, literally, you talk about travel in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah.
One of the results records that I've done over the years of the champions is Pat O'Connor's.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. You look at Pat O'Connor's record from the day he won the title to when he lost it. And this poor man, he didn't have time to eat lunch, and he was all over. It wasn't a matter of, you know, you wrestle in Des Moines, Iowa one night and you wrestle in Davenport the next. No. You wrestle in Iowa one night and the next night you're in New Zealand and you're doing a couple of matches there. And then before you know it, you're in Japan and then you're up in Montreal, Canada, and then you're back down into Kansas City, you know. I mean, if you look at it, it's like, how did he do it?
Yeah.
And I remember Harley Race saying one time, and Harley Race was one of the most traveled champions. And Harley said one time, he said that unless he physically looks at the calendar every single morning, he has no idea what day it is or what the date is. He has to look at it because he was never in the same place for more than a couple nights. So that formula with the traveling champion, that was different because if you were a member of the NWA and, you know, the NWA champion would work San Francisco, he would work Florida, Tampa, Miami, wherever. And I say San Francisco, it was also Los Angeles. It's California. He'd work Hawaii. He'd go up into the Pacific Northwest. He'd be down in Southwest Territory, Mid-South. Mid-Atlantic, up into Canada, you know, Toronto, etc. And you can just see that he really was just a champion. And he had no home. He didn't see his family. So,
yeah. Yeah.
It's funny when I say that because I remember sitting with Jack Briscoe at Cauliflower Alley one year. Jack liked to sit up to the bar and have a couple of drinks. He was a fun guy. I had a chance to sit with him about three times and just sit there with him. He bought me a beer. I only had one. I think he had three or four to my one. But, you know, he's the heavyweight champ. He can carry more than I can.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, I remember him telling me that literally he didn't know where he was half the time. And he said, and as far as having a family, he said, you go away, you know, you find out you're a father, you go away and you come home and the kid's graduating. Yeah. And it was joking, but it was almost true.
Yeah.
So, bottom line on that is that's just the way the NWA worked. And what happened too, though, when I mentioned those egos, you had promoters that all of a sudden they wanted their guy or they wanted this guy. And some of them would band together, you know, they'd get together before the annual meeting and say, you know, you support me and I'll support you. And, you know, and it's like any organization, you always got these little cliques and different things, you know, and you know, we're going to vote on this guy or that guy. That 3-year thing or 2 to 3 year thing, generally that worked. Generally that worked. There were a couple of times when the NWA felt that it wasn't working. One of them was when, 56. I'm going to say 56 without looking. 1956, Lou Thesz, he'd been champion. He kind of was tired of the routine and the travel, and he wanted to have the title taken off for a little bit. But he was very stubborn, and because he was the draw that he was for all promoters, you know, you put Lou Thesz on your card, marquee, it's big deal. So he had clout. He had a certain pull with the NWA. Or Butch Nick, et cetera. And he went to Sab and said, you know, basically I got to have a break. So I'll lose the title, but he was very specific in who he would lose it to. Now, in most cases, you know, some promoters in a lot of territories would say, well, you're not going to tell me how to run the promotion or this, but he chose his guy. And the one he chose was Dick Hutton. And again, on paper, that was a fantastic choice. Dick Hutton was a real wrestler. He was a guy that he knew how to break your arm off and hand it to you without you knowing he took it off.
Yeah.
He would have been the guy that could defend the title. He had a great amateur background. Him and Vern Gagne and a few others were in the Olympics together. Yeah. And, or, you know, at the same time. And, so, yeah, that was Thesz. He says, I want Dick Hutton to be the champion. Well, they did it. They put the title on Hutton. And the problem was, is that as good as Dick Hutton was, he lacked that charisma, that whatever that it factor was, to draw fans. He just didn't have the pull that Lou Thesz did. So after just a short time, it was decided that we have to take the title off of Dick Hutton. And the vote came around to Pat O'Connor. Again, a very credible. And one of the things that the NWA, Sam Muchnick, and most of the promoters did in those days, Brian, they wanted the champion to look like a champion. They didn't want, and as they described it, we don't want a character. We don't want a gimmick. So we don't want some flashy blowhard, you know, the champion had to be, for lack of a better word, a normal looking guy that put a suit on and represented the championship with class. He'd come into a town wearing a suit, tie. He'd be polite. He was the champion. It was something that he was representing. So the NWA was very careful about that in those early years. And you see, when you look at their earliest champions, you had Luthez, you had Whipper Billy Watson up in Canada for a short time. And he was just that type of a wrestler. You had Dick Hutton, who was at that point in his career, was definitely not a showman. He was a wrestler. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Pat O'Connor. So that was their formula. They wanted that guy to be able to be respected and to look the part of a what they considered a champion.
Yeah, I just, you know, back in those days, those, I always wondered why a person, you know, I could see for a year based on the schedule, but a guy would, you know, like you said, he wouldn't know who his kids were, hardly, and I just.
You mean I'm married? How,
yeah, and I just don't see how a man, even back then, could really withstand, or I don't want to say tolerate, but kind of withstand that much of a schedule, especially back then. You didn't have internet, you didn't have email, you didn't have, only way to communicate if you were long distance was writing a letter or a long distance phone call, which was an arm and a leg back then to call your family.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of wondered, maybe even some insight on this. I know once you reach the top, okay, I'm at the top, I'm the man. Right. And it's probably good for about 6 months. And then I'm sure you're starting to get burned out. And I'm just kind of wondering if you ever talked to like Harley or Jack or Dory.
Jack was the one that I had the opportunity to talk about that specific thing to. Mm-hmm. And Jack just told me, and it's common knowledge out there. People have said, well, Jack physically went to the NWA after 2 years and said, mm-hmm. I've had enough. You know, he mm-hmm. was making good money, but he the travel, he said, I need to lose the title. You know, they were willing to go, and he had a great career after the title. He didn't need, you know, he had the draw and the ability to, and being a former champion, that was always a plus when you're advertised for a card. So Jack told me that, you know, it was himself that went to Muchnick, to the committee, whoever you want to, and just basically say, you know what, we got to make some plans. I got to drop this. And, you know, that's moving ahead a little bit in champions, but yeah, that's how it happened with him. And so eventually we know that he lost it to Terry Funk.
Right.
And Terry was champion for a while. What I want to do, though, is I want to back up because we were talking about it. It kind of came to me here. I want to mm-hmm. talk about Pat O'Connor for a second.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So Pat is champion. Boy, he got it in 59, and he had it until 61. So mm-hmm. Roughly a three-year span, two-and-a-half-year, three-year span. And what was going on then, Brian, there were already some, I guess you'd call some breakage or some cracks in the foundation of the NWA a little bit, because some of the powers that be, one of them being the East Coast faction of Vince McMahon. Now the WWWF was not around at that time. It wasn't right. Probably not even thought of. It was Capital Sports. Just a small Northeast territory promotion. But Vince Sr. had clout. And okay. there was a lot of push. And he actually was booking, the way I understand it now, he was actually booking Buddy Rogers. He was the one that
right.
sent Buddy Rogers around to various promotions. And there was a huge push to put the title on Buddy. By the time we get to that 2.5-3 year mark, Pat O'Connor, he was ready to, you know, mm-hmm. I'm ready to step down. And it was put on Rogers. It was a very successful title reign for Buddy Rogers. Again, if you look at his record, which I do have, he was all over. But as he got into being champion for a while, you'll notice that the record shifts to where a lot of his title matches are in the Northeast Territory. A lot of his title matches are in Toronto, you know, where all of a sudden, all of these other promoters that are allegedly paid, well, they paid dues, they are members, they're not getting the champion or getting him nearly as much as they should. And so that's where the crack came in. And a lot of people were just get a lot of the promoters and Muchnick were just getting fed up with Rogers as champion for that reason. So what he did was he put a call in to his old buddy Lou Thesz.
Yeah.
And Lou, I will point out that in 1963, that was when Buddy lost the title to him. By that time, Lou was pretty much, shall we say, semi-retired. You know, he wasn't full-time. But Muchnick went to Lou. That was their go-to guy. He was the policeman. And he went to Lou and said, you know what, we're going to have to bring you in here to take the title off of Buddy. Well, the problem came in is that the East Coast group now did not want Buddy Rogers to lose the championship. So now we had that for the first time about a decade and a few years, we had that crack happening in the NWA. Mm-hmm. And it came down to the fact that Lou Thesz was going to take the title from Buddy. Now, there's a great story that's been told. I've never heard it personally, but it's been told so many times, I'll just share it. I'm guessing it's true because this is the way Lou would have worked. Buddy Rose. We don't have Buddy Rose here. I must have Paul Preston on my mind today. Rogers didn't want to even wrestle Lou Thesz because they had some animosity over the years. And the problem was, and Hornbaker talked about this in his book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's in Hooker as well. Lou Thesz's book, Hooker.
Yeah.
He admits he didn't like Buddy Rogers because Buddy Rogers was not a wrestler. That's where Lou's problem come in. And for whatever reason, because of his drawing power, he had that ability to keep the promoters on his side. And he didn't want to even wrestle Buddy Rogers sometimes because Rogers was the flamboyant strutting character, you know, boastful champion, which was different from the old NWA fold. So when the match came about, it was decided that the NWA, despite the wants of the East Coast group, Daddy McMahon was part of that. Toots Mann, I forget all the people involved.
Right.
But anyway, they weren't on board with it. But the match was set. Lou Thesz basically went to Buddy Rogers, and this is the part that's been repeated a million times. And Lou went to him and just really said, Buddy, I'm going to beat you tonight for the title. We can do it the easy way, which means you cooperate, you put a good match on, we make this good for the fans, or we can do it the hard way. And that hard way would have been, Buddy, I'm going to kick your butt and you're going to go home hurting. Okay? And that's really what that meant if you dissect that comment. Well, we know that Buddy cooperated, Lou got the title. But what happened out of that, and this is 1963, is that East Coast group, they decided we're not going to recognize Lou Thesz as champion. You know, Buddy Rogers is still our champion. He's still the champ. Mm-hmm. So there was that break. Now you had the first issue with the NWA. And Buddy then was touted as he the one that they said he had won a title recognition in Rio de Janeiro or something? It was one of those. They always seem to use Puerto Rico or Rio de Janeiro something.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was the champ. But the problem was, and again, this is where I wish, and I have wished this for many years. I personally don't know if it's true or if it's part of the storyline, but I really wish someone would come come forth and be honest that was there. And grant you, there's nobody left. But the story was, is that Buddy was having some heart problems. He was having health problems. And so whether or not he could be champion was an issue. And so that was about the time they decided that Bruno Sammartino was ready to go. Bruno had been being groomed around the East Coast and Canada, Toronto area, everything for, about 2 or 3 years as a strong man, as a top draw. And he had drawing power. So that's where it came from. So they come up with this. Bruno Sammartino is going to beat Buddy Rogers, who was now recognized as the official first World Wrestling Federation champion. And, of course, we know that Bruno came in and beat Buddy in something like 17 seconds. It was
quick.
It was a real quick match. And part of that is because of that story, whether it is true or not, that Buddy couldn't go any longer. Yeah. He basically came in to let Bruno put him in the bear hug and win the title. So that was where now we've got two promotions from the NWA. Yeah. But we do need to back up. If you have, you have a question on there or something you want to throw in?
I was going to back it up a little bit about the Minneapolis Boxing and Wrestling Club, if that's where you're going.
Let's back up with the NWA for a little bit farther back, even before Dick Hutton. In 1955, there was a match out in San Francisco where Leo Domellini won the title, supposedly won the NWA title from Lou Thesz. Now, this is a weird deal because they came back after the match and the NWA. When I say NWA, I'm just going to say we're probably referring to Muchnick. Yeah. But came forward and said, well, the match was on a disqualification or whatever the ending was, and the title did not change hands. So Lou was still defending in these other cities, except in San Francisco. He was billed and wrestled as the National Wrestling Alliance World Champion. Now, here's where I have the problem and the logic. Though the NWA officially says they didn't recognize Nomalini, they did allow him to be recognized as NWA champion in those defenses and around San Francisco. And the fact is, and I've got a couple programs that actually list him, NWA World Champion Leo Nomalini defending to whoever. Well, those fans that went to those matches during that short recognition, how do you tell them that he wasn't really the world champion when that's what they were paying on the marquee to see? So the NWA didn't recognize it, but eventually there was another match between Thesz and Leo, and they claim to clear up the controversy.
Yeah.
But for that instance, for a very short time, there were two NWA champions at the same time. Now, we also know that in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1957 in June, that was when Thesz wrestled Edward Carpentier.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an interesting faction going on behind the scenes there because the promoter in Montreal, who I believe was Eddie Quinn at the time, it was Eddie Quinn. He actually was the guy that booked and promoted Carpentier for matches. A lot of these guys just had a promoter that handled their bookings. And this was the case. So obviously, Eddie Quinn was kind of in business for himself, wanting, and this was in Montreal, kind of wanting Edward as champion. Well, they had the match in June, and it was a one fall. It was supposed to be a 2 out of 3 fall match. The match only ended up being one fall, supposedly. Now, I don't know if this was a work. I don't know if this was part of the storyline that for them to rely on later on. Again, somebody come forward that was there and tell me. Come from the grave and tell us the truth. But the story was is that Lou got hurt. He hurt his back. and was unable to continue for the rest of the match. So there was only one fall, and Carpentier won that fall. So he was recognized, had his hand raised, as the champion. Now, again, we'll point out that Lou then was going to other territories, defending the title, but they also allowed Carpentier to go around and defend the title. NWA world champion, Carpentier, definitely in Montreal. The biggest city that had this recognition was Omaha, Nebraska. Now, when I say Omaha, Nebraska, you say, well, one little town. It was Nebraska and surrounding cities, whatever the territory boundaries were at that time.
Right.
And then eventually the NWA allowed this again. So Carpentier was never officially by their records listed. But try to tell that to the Nebraska, the Montreal fans who had that. So from that Omaha recognition for Carpentier, the promoter at the time was Joe Dusick. And Dusick was recognizing him as the world heavyweight champion, not necessarily putting NWA in front of it. Well, at that time, fans are going to be able to go back and see that in 57, 58, it says AWA champion Edward Carpentier, or it might even say in some reports AWA champion Vern Gagne. But that wasn't the AWA that eventually happened in Minneapolis a couple of years down the road. So, and what happened is Carpentier was recognized as champion. A year later in Omaha, he lost that version of the title to Vern Gagne. And Vern was recognized as world champion in Omaha territory. But everywhere else, he was recognized as the United States champion.
Yeah.
And it was weird because they only had one belt at the time. Yeah. And Vern, depending on where he was, so he was world champion, let's just say, of Nebraska.
At Nebraska.
Okay. But he was the United States champion. So now we go forward, and one of the most famous breaks, because we had the 63 one, but there is one before that. Mm-hmm. And that's Vern Gagne. We have the NWA territory in Minneapolis. And the NWA, we mentioned Hornbaker, that great book. And he talks about the happenings within the business and the NWA at the time. The United States Justice Department, this is the nutshell version, folks. The U.S. Department of Justice was investigating the NWA for allegedly being a monopoly. Mm-hmm. Well, we know what a monopoly is. We've all played Parker Brothers' famous game. You know, the guy that ends up with the whole board, you know, and all the money, you win. You've got the monopoly. It's a simple concept. Well, if you're honest, that's what the NWA was. Because they controlled the champion, and we allegedly didn't have other world champions. So this investigation is going on, and the NWA, Sam Muchnick, et cetera, his cohorts, they decide they're going to give up a couple cities here and there. Well, Minneapolis was one of them. And the Minneapolis Boxing and Wrestling Club all through the 50s had been NWA promoted. Whenever the champ would come into the city, and we used to get the champion here in the Twin Cities once or twice a year on average. And it was a big deal, but it was the NWA world champion. So we know that in 1959, September, Dennis Stecker, who was then the promoter, he was the son of Tony Stecker, who had been the original promoter, who had passed away in 1954.
Yeah.
And Wally Carbo was Dennis's right-hand man. Well, Dennis and family wanted to get away from the wrestling business. For whatever the reasons were, they wanted to get out. Yeah. And Dennis he didn't have his heart in it as much as Tony, his dad, did, or Tony's brother, Joe, who was a great wrestler back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. So Dennis wanted to get out. Well, it was just convenient because here's Minnesota-born Vern Gagne, and Vern can now come in and buy the promotion, buy the Minneapolis Wrestling Club. It was Minneapolis Boxing and Wrestling Club, but boxing was secondary. So buy the wrestling club from the Stecker family, which he and Wally Carbo did. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, they were 50-50 partners. So this was in September of 59. And I should be able to recite this story in my sleep. In May of 60, so about, 9 months after they had bought the territory, the NWA champion had still come in a couple of times, which was, by the way, Pat O'Connor, had still come into the Minneapolis territory and defended the NWA title. But in May of 60, that's when they started the fictitious storyline, the fabricated storyline angle that Vern Gagne, actually the promoters, Wally Carbo, et cetera, were putting a challenge out to NWA champion Pat O'Connor and the NWA, because basically it was to the NWA for their champion, whoever it would have been, to defend to Vern. And that's where the 90-day thing came in. It was in May of 60. There was like a 90-day story that they've been contacted. They've been served notice. Vern wants that. He's the number one contender. He wants to have a championship match. Now, I will point out that one of the reasons this was also happening and Vern buying the territory was Vern had gained his own frustration because it became apparent to him that he wasn't going to get the NWA title. And they always use the story he was too small. But the reality was when Luthez was in power, for whatever reason, they had a professional jealousy or rivalry, and Lou wasn't going to put him over. And that was Lou. I'm not going to put him over. Vern's great. Yeah. I love the guy, but I won't put him over.
Right.
So anyway, we got Pat O'Connor's champ. The challenge is out. 90 days. And the stipulation was, Brian, that within that 90 days, if the NWA fails to respond with a match set or their champion defends, then the Minneapolis Wrestling Club will no longer recognize the NWA world champion. Simple enough.
Yeah.
Well, we get to August, and the challenge, they and in the programs, it's great because they have these little stories where no response from champion O'Connor, NWA refuses to acknowledge, you know, the title match, the whatever. And so we get to close to August, the 90 days has passed. And this was the plan because behind the scenes, the NWA had agreed to give up Minneapolis. Now, when we say Minneapolis again, we're talking surrounding areas, whatever the Minneapolis Boxing and Wrestling Club promoted, that was their territory. They had agreed to give it up because of that U.S. Justice investigation. And so by doing this, they were saying, okay, we're not a monopoly. There's other champions. There's other groups. But we didn't know that on the surface. We just knew Vern had thrown out this challenge and Pat O'Connor was a coward and he wouldn't defend. So in August of 60, that's when it's announced that by default, Vern Gagne is now being recognized because the champion failed to accept his challenge, that we are now recognizing Vern Gagne as, and they created the American Wrestling Alliance. And Vern was the first champion. And that's one of the most famous stories. And of course, we do know that there are websites out there that say Pat O'Connor was the first champion. Yeah. Not true, folks.
And that's not true.
That's going to be on my tombstone, you know. Pat O'Connor was not AWA champion. So now we had the AWA in business. In 63, we had that break with Buddy Rogers and Sammartino coming in. 1964, there was another break because they started to recognize in Los Angeles and surrounding areas, they started recognizing what they were calling the WWA. And I think at the time it was the, I actually think it was the world. I thought there was a worldwide in that too, originally, Worldwide Wrestling Association or something, but it was WWA. And that was, they were stemming their so-called claim to the title off of that Carpentier match that had happened in 57. Because the follow-through happened where I think it was, and again, I'm not looking.
Yeah.
I got to think about this. I think it was Fred Blassie.
Classy Fred Blassie.
I think it Classy Freddie Blassie. I think he was the one that allegedly beat Carpentier, and he was the champion. He had some matches. He wrestled against Dick the Bruiser. He wrestled against the Destroyer, Mass Destroyer. It was, Bob Ellis was in there, some great matches. And then eventually in 64, Bruiser won the title. But actually, they said it didn't, whatever the storyline was in Los Angeles, they were still recognizing Blassie. But Bruiser left with the WWA title and went to Indianapolis, which was his home.
Yeah.
And he started his own champion, his own territory in 64. So now we had the World Wrestling, what did Bruiser call his? The World Wrestling Association, I think it was.
Association, yeah.
WWA.
I think so.
And then we had the WWA in California for a little bit, which I think was Alliance. You're going to make me go look this up after we're done here now, because I'm going to have to fix it for myself. But allegedly, we had two different titles there. So the NWA no longer had their monopoly problems. That was solved. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we moved forward. So now we had the AWA, the NWA, the WWA, and the WWWF. And so now we had all these things we talked about at the beginning of our show, all these different champions. And there were other smaller promotions that would recognize a world champion that nobody could ever figure out wasn't. But those were the big three. And the WWA Indianapolis became like number four. That's how it worked.
One last question.
Oh, boy.
Before we get off of here. Is what do you really believe was the demise, the end, really, in the 80s of the NWA? What do you think just that crack just came to a biggest, you know, hole and just swallowed that up? What do you believe was the final nail in the coffin, if you will?
I would have to offer you probably more opinion.
Okay.
And that's with fine. It,
I love opinions.
And, well, and with it, there's some fact. By the time Sam Muchnick had decided to step down as president, and I will point out that during his long run, there was a brief time previously that he had stepped down for a very short time, but he had come back. He was the guy. Remember I said earlier, he was the glue. Yeah. He's the one that kept it together. And always, he was the one that was always able to negotiate with the guys and be the voice of reason with them. You know, if they had issues okay. So I think by the time we got in there, when the presidency was being bounced around to Fritz von Erich or Jack Adkison. He was president under his own name, Fritz von Erich. It was Jack Adkison. But he was president for a while. Eddie Graham ended up being president for a while. Then we know Bob Geigel was was president for a while. I think that's when that started to happen, you no longer had the cohesiveness. Plus, we got to remember that by the 80s, the wrestling business was changing in how it was promoted, how it could be presented. Excuse me. We know that, you know, certainly by the 80s, closed circuit capabilities were available. So promoters could go outside their box, so to speak.
Yeah.
We know that pay-per-view was kind of shining its light on us. We know that the aggressiveness started in 82 or 3 with Vince Jr. in yep. his group. And it just, the promoters were fighting amongst themselves. And before you know it, the NWA was no longer powerful. Hornby put out, we keep mentioning him, but he does good job. He's got his book out on Ric Flair, which mm-hmm. he calls The Last Real World Champion. Mm-hmm. That's true, but I am more inclined to believe that Harley Race was the last real NWA traveling champion. Because by the time Flair was in that 80s, early 80s into the 80s, he was playing favorites to just a couple of promoters, and a couple of promoters were running the show, and the NWA was no longer the NWA as we knew it for two and a half decades. So to answer your question, I think that's when it all started. Sam, when we lost Sam Muchnick and the business as we knew was changing, that's how it all happened. And before you know it, Crockett was taken over and promoters were buying each other out. And then Vince was putting everybody out of business. And, the rest is history.
Indeed. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Mr. George Shire again. My partner in crime. Appreciate you coming on today and giving us your insight. And always a pleasure to have you on, sir. Thank you so much.
I'm always glad that we can chat, and it helps my memory stay alive too.
Yeah, there you go. All right, folks. Thank you. If you're listening, thank you. If you're watching, thank you. And if you haven't subscribed, please do so, and we will talk to you soon.
Hey, this is a Total Package, Lex Luger. You're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
VOC Nation's own Stro Maestro suffered a major medical and financial catastrophe this year. From the VOC Nation family, to all of you, please continue to pray for Stro Maestro for his continued recovery. You can also donate to his cause. PayPal.me/PapaStro.
The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Check out In the Room
every Tuesday night at 9. Listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Kazzy Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are, and we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus,
I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into like snuff film territory there.
In the Room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Yo, this is Jerry Steins of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobs here. You get ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby.
VOC Nation is one of the longest running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Works. Archive-free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Phil Apter has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Hey, Tony here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill Apter's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my own.
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Ram, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, Apter's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is? Well, I'll tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found a true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think... I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was a hell of a champion.
Here are exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill Apter, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a loss.
Did Brennan have anything to do?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. Head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro. Talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out, vocnation.com, WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation radio network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.